With our guest tonight, James Norman, the author of the book, The Oil Card. In the last hour of the program, Jim Berkland joins us as we talk about Yellowstone's earthquakes. And then next hour, we'll have the phone lines open for questions with James. But I'll be back with more with him in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, James Norman, our special guest here. James, it is a remarkable situation with all these things occurring at about the same time. It's almost like somebody sat back and planned it. They can't be that smart, can they?
Well, you know, that is the key criticism of my book. People would say, oh, come on, the government can't be that smart to organize all this stuff. But I point out in the book, the government can't be this dumb to do so many stupid things along the way that pushed up the price of oil to $150 a barrel and do nothing to stop it. It had to have been an intentional policy. It's what I call the dog that didn't bark syndrome, you know, from a Sherlock Holmes story. You know, the government sat back and did nothing as that price ran up, sat on their hands. And what's more important is in the 1980s, there's a paper trail documented. People from the Reagan National Security Council came out of the woodwork and bragged about how they busted the Russians, the Soviets, with low oil prices back then. So we've done it before. We can do it again. We're good at it. In fact, a lot of the same people who were in that Reagan National Security Council, there's a guy on Cheney's staff now. I mean, they're just doing what comes naturally. I think they have a fairly limited playbook of stuff that they know how to do well, and moving oil prices around is high on the list.
It's a touchdown pass for them, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's not a Hail Mary either. I mean, it's they know how to do this. In fact, actually, talking about Hail Mary, let me just mention Iraq, how Iraq fits into this. I mentioned this in the book. You know, we've never had a decent explanation out of Washington as to why we invaded Iraq, let alone Afghanistan.
Weapons of mass destruction, James.
Yeah, or Al-Qaeda. But look, all that stuff is baloney. The real reason we went in there, and I just state this flat out, is because of China. When Saddam was still in control, he had started to do deals with the Chinese and other countries to actually sell them the rights to oil in the ground, equity reserves in the ground, not just tanker loads of crude, but actually ownership of the reserves in the ground.
For big dollars.
Well, yeah, actually what it was is for the commitment of those countries to come in and develop those fields, turn them into cash for him so he wouldn't have to spend his own money. Now,
and that's literally his own money, right?
Well, yeah, in effect. But as long as UN sanctions were in place, those countries couldn't come in and touch those fields. But they were due to expire at the end of 2003. That's when the UN sanctions would have been lifted. And at that point, the Chinese were preparing to move probably tens of thousands of, quote, oil field workers in to essentially garrison at least one, probably two, and maybe many more very large oil fields there. Once you had Chinese boots on the ground in Iraq, the whole game would change. No longer
Absolutely.
Could we go in and just bomb them whenever we felt like. I mean, and worse than that, that would be actually a direct violation of what's called the Carter Doctrine, which actually came into existence during Jimmy Carter's reign. 1980, the big new Brzezinski enunciated it, basically said this: if any outside power moves to gain control of Middle East oil reserves, the United States will regard that as a direct threat to our national security and will respond militarily if necessary.
And interesting that Brzezinski is going to attach himself to Obama, and so he'll still be hanging around.
Well, this is my point. What I say in this book, it's really not a Democrat-Republican thing. It's not a left-right kind of thing. This whole thing is driven by a national security agenda, and there's really, look, the national security mindset, this juggernaut just rolls on regardless of which cardboard cutout you've got standing up reading the teleprompter on those presidential speeches.
Well, and James, is it national security or is it national greed for a few?
It's probably hard to tell a difference between that. You know, I think they're in their own minds, they could probably confuse that very well.
Because, you know, I see what's happening now around this country with these massive layoffs, jobs being cut worldwide now. Alcoa just announced 13,500 cutbacks. But the greedy few at the top are going to make a lot of money on this. You know, this bailout money, that they won't tell us where it's gone, who gets it, why. I mean, it's the biggest sham I've ever seen, and it continues.
Yeah, but the way they're able to rationalize it, I'm convinced, is under the auspices of national security. I mean, that's their all-purpose rationale for doing whatever they want to do, and it's potent. It's very powerful. And, you know, as I point out in the book, in this oil price manipulation scheme, it's really the question becomes, who in the government does this? What I note in the book is that it was the National Security Council in the 80s that did it. Now there is what's called the President's Working Group on Financial Markets, the so-called Plunge Protection Team. It's headed by the Secretary of the Treasury, got the head of the SEC, Commodity Futures Trading Commission, Federal Reserve New York. On an ad hoc basis, it's also got the heads of the NYMEX, the New York Stock Exchange, the Amex. It's, to my way of thinking, it's this group now, which is really the economic warfare equivalent of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. These guys call the shots, and they command significant amounts of forces in the form of basically government slush funds, mainly managed by the New York Federal Reserve, which is why it's interesting to me that Obama's picked Tim Geithner to come in as Treasury Secretary. Geithner's been running the New York Fed. I mean, he's been a point man on a lot of this stuff.
They're all the same, James.
It's a team. Yeah.
And it's been a team for a long time. I had an astrologer on who deals with financial and global politics. And he said nothing's changed. These are the same folks that have been around for 40 years, and they just keep plodding along.
Well, yeah, I think that because it is a national security elite, there's really a limited pool of people to draw from for these jobs. That's why you keep seeing Leon Panetta's name showing up.
No intelligence experience, and he's running the CIA soon.
Well, you see, you don't know what role he's had in intelligence matters in years past. I mean, he's had various titles, never overtly with the CIA, but, I mean, when he was in the Clinton White House, he would certainly have had high-level security clearances. I mean, my working hypothesis is the people who really call the shots on these things are not the ones that you see on TV or who become household names. I mean, it's a deep bureaucracy of people and talent there, I guess you'd call it talent, that go on doing this stuff.
I get into a massive argument on this show with a guest, Matt Sevenar, who's a believer in peak oil. He says, we've peaked, it's coming down, and this planet is running out of oil. I, on the other hand, I'm a believer of the abiotic oil theory, James. I believe this planet produces it in abundance. I do not believe on the simple fossil fuel theory. There's just way too much oil on this planet to believe that. I don't think this planet will run out of oil in our lifetime.
Right, You're right. We're going to run out of demand long before we run out of oil. But you have to think of this peak oil mantra, again, as part of this economic warfare effort.
Now he believes this, though.
A lot of people believe it. And the proponents of it, I'm sure they believe it themselves, but nevertheless, this whole peak oil thing has been used as a propaganda bludgeon to try and it's necessary. You know, as Churchill said, that in times of war, truth can only go anywhere protected with a bodyguard of lies. Well, peak oil is one of these lies, and it's basically, in order to get the price up and keep it up, you've got to convince the world we're running out of oil. And so
Absolutely. This
peak oil thing, this theory's been around for decades, but they drag this out and dust it off and embellish it. What's interesting, though, is that one of the key proponents of this is Matt Simmons, who's an investment banker down in Houston. I know Matt. In fact, I wrote one of the first stories about him at Business Week when I was in Houston in the 80s. At that time, he was preaching exactly the opposite gospel, saying oil prices will never recover. They'll always be low. And by the way, you better hire my firm to merge your oil field service companies together to save your money. So, I mean, he may be completely sincere. Unfortunately, he's inherently conflicted in some of this stuff, and he's changed his tune. He says he had a great epiphany in the early 90s, noting that the Saudis were going to run out of oil. Well, in fact, None of these predictions have been true. The Saudis still have plenty of oil on the ground. They just announced 3 new discoveries today. They have ample unused production capacity. The Saudis are not about to run out of oil. There's lots more oil being found. I'm actually on your side on the abiotic oil thing. I think the Earth's core, it's always churning, it's grinding, it's basically generating all kinds of hydrogen, helium, carbon dioxide, gases that are venting to the surface. And as those gases come to the surface, they combine with carbon, you get hydrocarbons. You bake them into long chains, you get petroleum. And that's why they're finding this stuff at depths far below sedimentary deposits, you know, in rock that's, you know, 18,000 feet deep and more. That didn't get there from dinosaurs.
No, especially also the oil that they would find on the bed of the ocean floor deep within that. I mean, my gosh, how did that get there?
Right. See, I think the Earth's crust is loaded with hydrocarbons. What you had with this price run up, there's been a resurgence of drilling. We've been finding a lot more of this stuff. Now, here's the prediction I have. If I'm right, and we're basically moving into another low price scenario here, what you're going to see is a spate of new oil discovery announcements.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see reserve revisions, companies reporting that,
upward.
A lot more there than we thought.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you're going to see the oil majors, who have been scrimping on the capital spending for the last 10 years, you're going to see them now move to a different posture where they're going to be spending much more of their cash flow, putting it back in the ground. They're going to keep their production up and probably increase it. And in fact, you know, the market has risen a bit on these hopes that OPEC is going to cut production. No, what happens in times like this, OPEC is prone to cheating. They love to cheat, and that's what happened in the 80s. That's partly when the Saudis started producing again, all of OPEC, they just went wild cheating. And you're probably going to see that again because all these governments, producing governments, they're desperate for cash. They'll have to produce more crude.
Absolutely. And they may not tell us they're doing it, but they will.
Yeah. Meanwhile, demand is falling. You know, U.S. gasoline consumption is down like 4% from a year ago in the last week.
Yeah. You know what's disappointing to the automobile industry, and it's got to be, you know, my father worked for his whole lifetime at Ford in Detroit. The prices are so low now, you would think automobile sales would be going through the roof, and they're plummeting by 30 or 40, 50%.
Right. Well, you know, when you go through a price shock and market shock like we've had, this takes a long time to get out of people's mind. I mean, we're all just...
People are afraid of spending money, James.
Exactly, right. Now, here's an interesting thing. You know, what you're also going to see is yet another round of draconian CAFE standard increases, corporate average fuel economy increase. The government is going to mandate much better efficiency from the automakers. Again, this is the same thing we did back in the 80s, the mid-80s, after prices had tanked, after the horse had left the barn. That's when we came in with these more fuel economy standards, which further drove down U.S. oil consumption. In the 80s, U.S. oil consumption fell from 20 million barrels a day to 16 million barrels a day, and it didn't recover for 20 years. I think you're going to see the same kind of thing happening where these are the levers we can pull. We can put more oil on the market. You know, we can decrease demand. There's a bunch of things that the government can do with even kind of subtle policy and regulatory moves that are going to could dramatically change the whole supply-demand picture on crude oil. And then we get to the NYMEX, which is another whole story, and I'll go into that. That's very complex, but
okay,
that's the key.
Ahead. Hey, give out your toll-free number again for you.
Hey, it's 1-800-556-2012. And there's also a website if you want to go read some more about this.
2012? How did you pick that number?
Coincidence. I don't know. Fate. Karma. It was not my decision.
And that's 1-800, not one of those other numbers. 1-800, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. There's also a website. It's called www.theoilcard.com. And there's some more stuff there. So.
Okay, great. Okay, now let's get back to you're talking about the futures exchange. And
yeah.
How do they manipulate that?
Okay, now, the key thing about this price run-up over the last year or so, people have said, oh, well, it was due to speculators. Well, Yes and no, because actually what happened was there was a flood of money into the futures exchange, the commodity futures in particular, and the crude futures contract in particular. Now, it wasn't really speculative money. It wasn't even so much hedge funds and that kind of stuff. It was really pension money, managed money, fiduciary managed money that should never have gone into commodity futures to begin with. But at the behest of Goldman Sachs and the other big Wall Street houses, they basically went to the pension funds and said, oh, look, we've got a risk-free way for you to invest your money in commodities. The price will only go up. Buy these commodity index investments, then we'll put that money to work in the futures market so that you'll get these returns. And and I think this is where the government was able to have a hand in this, because I think with just a few phone calls to a few large government-affiliated pension funds like CalPERS, Hermes, and the UK, they plowed billions of dollars.
How about AIG? Were they involved in any of this?
Well, AIG...
because they bailed them out really fast. There was something going on there.
AIG is an interesting story in itself in another regard, and I'll come back to that.
Come back to that, okay.
They don't really play in the NYMEX futures so much, but you see, the only way this could happen is if the Commodity Futures Trading Commission basically suspended what are called position limits on the big banks. Position limits are designed to prevent speculators from grabbing control of the market. Says it limits the amount of money you can put in on a speculative basis into these actually rather small markets, like the crude market. What they did for the Wall Street banks that were taking in this pension money, turning it into contracts on the futures exchange, they basically suspended the position limits so that the so-called, they're called swap desks on these big banks, they were able to pour unlimited amounts of money into this market. It was like a fire hose. It was a torrent of money flowing into these markets that completely, and all of it was on the buy side. They were all buying crude futures, and they overwhelmed the sellers. So they, and anybody who was a seller during this run-up got slaughtered, the so-called shorts, the sellers.
Oh, sure. Wiped out.
So you basically decimated the shorts. You overwhelmed them with buying. The market just ran up. It could have gone to $200 a barrel. It could have gone to $300 a barrel, as Boone Pickens was predicting. But then I think the Russians just kind of, they changed their game plan, and I think we just threw the lever the other way. And since then, there's been a massive outrush of the same money out of these commodity index plays. And so the figure went, it had gotten up to, it had gone from like nothing to like $260 billion worth of investment in a period of a couple of years. Now it's back down to under $100 billion and kind of bumping along there. But you could see that basically by, it's like the Mississippi River. You just dig a channel there and you channel part of that river into a swamp somewhere and you could flood the swamp. Well, that's sort of what we did. I mean, it's like no heavy lifting at all for the government, with just a kind of a deft regulatory decision, an obscure change in a regulation somewhere, you can channel a large amount of money into a market like crude, and you can do all kinds of stuff there, damage.
Truly remarkable, James, what they do and the ability and how they manipulate. And yeah. So they must be sitting in these little tiny corner offices. Well, I guess they're not little and tiny, are they? They're probably huge, but they're sitting down there just deciding the fate of the world.
Well, I think that, yeah, in effect. And, you know, there's an interesting quote in the book. I pulled that out from a magazine article where basically somebody in the Bush administration, some journalist was talking to him, you know, well, but what about this? What about that? And this guy just stopped him short and says, look, the trouble with all you guys in the press is that you're reality-based. You look at what's going on and you try to figure it out. Well, we're so far down the road, we create our own reality. We're the actors. We make things happen, you know, and all you can do is sit back and try and figure it out. By the time you do, we're way down the road in the next deal.
James is like playing chess with the late Bobby Fischer. He was 60 moves ahead of us.
Right.
We'll be back in a moment. Well, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. We'll give you an opportunity to chat with James Norman. When we come right back, we'll chat more with him on Coast to Coast AM. We're with James Norman, author of The Oil Card. James, let's talk a little bit about this credit crunch now, this meltdown, and how it's tied into some of these things. But also, I do want to get your take on AIG, in as much as you've got that kind of experience. And also, tell us a little bit about Enron. What did you see when you had that critical analysis of Enron's accounting that helped trigger this SEC investigation, which led to their corrupt downfall? What did you see? What were some of the flags there?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's do the AIG thing real quick. Now, I don't pretend to be an expert on AIG, but it was interesting to me that the government stepped in and bailed that company out the way it did. Now, what's interesting is that the main problem in AIG was out of their London subsidiary, which had been writing credit default insurance and inadvertently, apparently, taking on huge risk. Now, what's interesting about that is that I think a lot of those contracts that they wrote, the debt that AIG was insuring was sovereign and other corporate debt related to Eastern European countries, countries around, you know, the former Soviet Union, that basically the West has been trying to wean away from relationship with Moscow, get them up on their own 2 feet, their own creditworthiness so that they could finance themselves apart from Russia. And a key element of that was offering debt guarantees that would make it possible for those countries to sell their debt into the public markets. It needed somebody like an AIG behind them to basically offer the, the mortgage insurance
guarantees,
make that
right?
debt marketable. So, you know, the other thing about AIG, going back to its original history, formed by Cornelius Starr selling insurance in China, I mean, the company has always had an aura of kind of spookiness associated with it. In fact, Hank Greenberg, the former CEO, was actually a candidate for director of Central Intelligence at one point, you might recall. So the company has had a rather symbiotic relationship with the government all along. In fact, I saw Greenberg interviewed by Maria Bartiromo on CNBC one time, about the time of the bailout, you know, and he was saying he didn't quite come to this point. He said, but it's like, sure, the government ought to bail us out. Look at what we've been doing for them for all these years.
Yeah, exactly.
So, in effect, I think the way the government works, again, we go through what look like normal commercial companies to accomplish geopolitical ends. In this case, propping up the finances of otherwise uncreditworthy countries that we are trying to basically pull out of the Russian orbit, cement them into Europe some way, get them up on their own 2 feet. I think those were the kind of dynamics at work and the thinking in mind with the government in deciding to actually bail out AIG.
And it sounded like the government didn't want the citizens, us,
poking around in the books.
Exactly, to know what was going on, to know what's been going on for a very long time.
Right. You know, now, you know, I'm not saying this in terms of AIG per se, but as a rule of thumb, the insurance business in general, if you want to launder money, insurance is a good way to do it. The essence of money laundering is a mispriced transaction. It's not carrying around bags of cash. It's large transactions mispriced. That's how you're able to move large amounts of money and get it into a bankable form, into somebody's bank account. And there's nothing that's easier to misprice than insurance, generally. The only other thing that's easier to misprice than insurance is oil and gas in the ground, because that's an imaginary figure that you could put almost any kind of a price tag on it.
So that's right. Exactly.
That's why the oil and gas business internationally, that's another great way to launder money. You know, you can misprice a deal, and who's to say you're wrong? But you can move large amounts of money one way or another, and who's to call it money laundering?
Did you ever come across a guy by the name of Leo Wanta?
Yes, the famous ambassador to, was it not Austria or something like that?
Yeah. This guy apparently had or was controlling trillions of dollars, and also they say that he helped contribute to the Soviet Union's demise. But apparently this money is still somewhere, I hear.
who knows? That whole thing was such a mystery. I actually talked to him at one point. This was back in the...
So he's a real guy.
Well, he's a live being, but he could be Joe the Plumber for all I know. It's such a bizarre story that as a journalist, you just couldn't go there. You just couldn't write about this guy credibly. It was just too strange. But I think the spook world love these kind of people. They have no credibility. They have no plausibility. The stories could be completely true, but who in their right mind could write about them?
They're so bizarre.
Yeah. Who knows? I mean,
How did you stumble across him? What had you heard?
Well, my life has been a little strange too. Yeah.
You're one of the few people who knows about this guy.
I know. Look. Before I went to work at Plath, I was working at Forbes magazine. I was a senior writer there. And there I stumbled into this incredible story about bank spying efforts by the U.S. government. And it actually was in connection with some work I was doing on the Innslaw case. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Oh, yeah, I sure do.
This is a case where the government purloined some useful software, which they then modified, and it was part of the allegations. So this promise, it was originally a prosecutor's management software, but it was adaptable. They put it into banking software so you could keep track of banking transactions. And what's interesting about this is one of the prime contractors for the National Security Agency to basically get this stuff customized and plant it into foreign money center banks was this Arkansas company called Systematics, later acquired by Altel. Systematics, very spooky company. Guess who was an attorney of record for Systematics? Hillary Clinton. Working at the Rose Law Firm under the auspices of Vince Foster, who I come to find out he had had a long relationship with the National Security Agency and was kind of the handler on behalf of Jackson Stevens, the owner of Systematics, in all of this stuff. And what got really weird is, in looking at this, I came to find out that at the time he died, Vince Foster was actually under counterintelligence surveillance. He was suspected of selling secrets, and he would have actually been in a position where he would have had access to all kinds of critical code, encryption stuff in the White House. That's why if you look at the Senate Banking Committee records on that, there's whole pages and pages of blacked out, redacted testimony from all the people around. The bizarre stuff about military intelligence teams sweeping his office immediately after he died, vacuuming up all the documents out of his office. And the government just went into overdrive to try and convince the world it was just a routine suicide. Move along, folks. There's nothing to look at here. Well, in fact, Foster, I'm told, had actually been under suspicion of selling secrets. To whom? The Chinese, for one, because they were out there ready market. They were buying this stuff up like mad. And it was at a time when, the Clinton crowd probably had large amounts of unpaid off-the-books expenses from the original, of the first election in 92. I think Vince was probably part of the team that was trying to pay off some of those debts. And where do you go? You go wherever you can, and you sell anything that isn't nailed down. This, I believe, is the reason Bill Clinton was impeached. It had nothing to do with Whitewater. Had nothing to do with Monica Lewinsky. The problem was there was a whole heap of national security problems on his watch. I mean, the Chinese were throwing money at the Clinton crowd left and right. They had scores of front men, bag men, from Charlie Tree to Gene and Nora Lum. You had John Wong getting CIA briefings at the Commerce Department. It was a disaster. In fact, that's why I think that the end of Clinton's, toward the end of about the time he was being impeached, that's when he had the sea change in U.S. policy toward China. Under Clinton, and actually under George H.W. Bush, we had basically maintained an attitude of, let's be nice to these guys, we'll all get along,
they'll behave,
we can all coexist, blah, 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 let's be nice to these guys.
We'll even help them with technology.
Well, we got most favored nation status. Bush won, got him most favored nation status. Clinton renewed it twice. But by the end of the 90s, it was clear the Chinese, it's just the nature of things. They're going to extend geopolitical dominance if they can. And they're going to lie, cheat, and steal on their trade agreements. I mean, they're basically pursuing a brutally classic mercantilist trade strategy, the beggar thy neighbor, snarf up as much hard currency as they can, build up their military might, and someday down the road, after being nice for a long time, they'll be in a position where they could call the shots on a confrontation with the United States somehow or other.
Taiwan especially.
Or whatever. I mean, there's a whole slew of potential flashpoints along there, which I detail in the book. In fact, the Chinese thought they had probably 20 years to get ready for this, according to one diplomat that I talked to.
There was any treason involved here?
Well, I don't know about treason. I think it was just venality, you know, just selling stuff. We need the money. You know, I don't think that anybody had, you know, malign intentions necessarily against the U.S. government, but I think they were desperate for cash, and they were willing to sell whatever they could, and the Chinese were ready buyers. So it was just a natural scheme of things, and I think
greed got it.
Yeah, that's what drove it. Rather mindless, I think, but stupid. And the Chinese were right there to buy this stuff. I mean, the Chinese have waged a concerted espionage effort against the United States, from computer hacking to compromising people to just infiltrating all of it. I mean, the Justice Department's gone ballistic about this stuff, and Commerce Department has had like 400 different investigations going on about Chinese secrecy thefts. I mean, so this is another dimension of economic warfare going on right under our noses here. This is the way things happen. But I think the Chinese thought they had 20 years to get strong to the point where they could provoke and win a confrontation with the U.S. And I think the national security establishment looked at that and said, you know, we're going to turn this clock forward. We're going to push it up on them. And one way you do that is raise the price of oil, raise the cost of all their industrial inputs, and slow down their economy so that they don't have as much time as they thought to get strong. And I think that it was starting to bite. I think it was starting to have an effect. And I think that, you know, in the last year or so, the Chinese actually did relent on a number of things. You know, they made nice with Taiwan. They made nice with Japan over an East China Sea dispute, although that may be falling apart now. I don't know. They finally relented to try and increase the value of the currency at a faster rate, but they've backtracked on that too. So, you know, I think that things are not good between the U.S. and China. I don't care how happy-faced they look on the surface.
I think under the table, they're
kicking each other in the shins like mad.
I agree. Hey, by the way, Hillary forgives a $13 million loan to her campaign. Where did she get that kind of money?
Some book deal. She probably was on your show hawking her book like me. She probably has anything in her.
No, she wasn't on this one.
Let me tell you, as a book author, this is no way to make a lot of money. It's you do it for just the love of truth. But for these celebrities who get these huge book deals, you know, where do these books end up? Does anybody actually buy them? I don't know.
You know what? I've got a book out with a partner of mine, and it did okay. But man, not like that.
No.
I mean, it was.
This is just another way to launder money into the pockets of the high and the mighty. Here, you give them a bogus book deal and slap their picture on the cover, and you know they can take the check to the bank.
That is amazing. Truly amazing. Well, through all this. We'll get into Enron a little bit later. But through all this, what are the key points that you have now, beyond a shadow of a doubt, convinced yourself is going on?
Well, I have no doubt that we wrecked the Soviets with low oil prices. And I think that we perfected those mechanisms to the point that we were able to use them in reverse against China. I think that there is serious economic warfare going on. And I think whenever you look at these hellacious economic events going on, you got to keep in the back of your mind, is this a manifestation of economic warfare by somebody against somebody else? It's hard to tell who's throwing the rocks here sometimes or who windows gets busted, but it explains a lot. And events are not as random as they might appear to be.
Jeez.
And markets can be managed. Not all the time, not every market, but at key points, critical intervention can move these markets. They can be out of whack sometimes for protracted periods of time.
I think we're going to have a slow first quarter, and then we're going to have a whip-around effect. And I don't know how long it'll last, James, but I think they're going to push it back up again.
You know, I've wondered about where it's going to go. I think basically the fundamentals on oil prices are still weak. Commodity prices are still weak. I think I think we're going to see a lot more pain before things get better. I think that.
Oh yeah.
I think we're going for the jugular on this. Putin's regime will be gone within a year or so.
Do you think all this is based on going to get Putin, even at letting us bleed?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Right. We bleed. They hemorrhage.
Yeah.
And I think China is going to blow up too. And you know, China is sitting. My view of China is it's really a house of cards. I mean, they have hitched their wagon to basically 19th century industrial strategies of building up steel plants, aluminum plants, They've taken over all of these dirty industries. The only way to justify the investments there is if they massively export this stuff. The world is not going to put up with that. They've financed themselves with massive amounts of bad loans in their banks. They're like 40% of the assets in their banks are non-performing loans. They desperately need to get recapitalized. What you've seen now is an unexpected drop in their exports. Now, this is extremely worrisome because they've been growing at like 20 or 30% a year. For them to go to zero is bad enough, but actually drop, this is troubling. Unemployment rising, bank problems, and if you start to see a capital outflow from China, the whole thing could just implode.
So, you know, it's kind of like trying to drown someone, and you're underwater with them, and you know you can hold your breath longer than they can.
That's it, yeah.
Yep.
I mean, the telltale thing.
What a horrible analogy.
If you started to see bank runs in China, I mean, it's curtains for those guys. In fact, there was a bank run in Hong Kong, and Li Ka-shing stepped in, basically recapitalized the bank himself and told everybody in town, look, if you don't play along with this, you'll never do business in Hong Kong again. So yeah, they were apoplectic about that, and they moved quickly to staunch that problem. But it could break out again elsewhere in China, I think.
What would you recommend American people do right now, James?
For investments, you mean?
Well, just with their own personal financial lifestyle.
Well, I would say, as always, you know, live within your means, eschew debt, invest conservatively, don't try to get rich quick, work for a living, and pray to God.
Do a lot of prayer.
Yeah.
A lot of prayer. Quickie, on Enron, how'd you decide to pinpoint that?
Well, you know, I'd been watching Enron for a long time and had avoided writing about it because I didn't want to get sucked into all the hoopla about that company because people had been telling me it's a house of cards and nobody could quite figure out why that was. But finally, when Jeff Skilling abruptly quit in the middle of 2001, I said, okay, I'm going to go after this company. He wouldn't be quitting unless there was a big problem there.
Yeah.
So I went at it and looked at it and said, you know, the problem was they were reporting profits and cash flow from what were really cash deposits that were coming in on this over-the-counter trading system they had for natural gas and other commodities.
Mm-hmm.
So it looked like it was real cash that they were earning coming in. In fact, it was just deposits from their counterparties on this. That's how they were keeping this thing afloat. The whole thing depended on Enron's credit rating. But really, what Enron was, it was an uncreditworthy company dressed up as a bankable credit.
That's a huge scandal.
So when I wrote this story about how they were basically manufacturing profits using mark-to-market accounting, which was they were just pulling numbers out of the air and reporting profits, managing their earnings, I wrote this story, sent an annotated copy to the SEC, to a guy I know there, and 3 days later, it turns out, that's when the SEC began their investigation of Enron, I think, because it was the stuff I specifically noted in this story that gave them plausible reason to investigate that company. It was when news of that investigation came out a couple of months later, that's when Enron's stock tanked, their credit ratings were wiped out, they went to junk bond rating, their credit dried up, and the whole thing was kaput within
over.
A matter of weeks.
It was over. We'll come right back. Now we're going to open up the phone lines for you, James. We'll have everyone chat with you.
Fire away.
What we've been talking about. You got it.